Welcome back to the second hour of Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm really pleased to have back with me once again Daniel Oliver. Daniel is the director of the Committee for Monetary Research and Education. It's a nonprofit educational organization that seeks to promote greater public understanding of the nature of money, the monetary process, and the central role that a healthy monetary system plays in the well-being, indeed, in the very survival of a free society. Dan is also the founder and managing director of Mermican Capital, or Mermican, I believe is the right way to say it. Mermican Capital.
Mermican, yeah.
Mermican. Dan was previously a partner at Baring Capital LLC, an asset management firm specializing in Latin American energy, commodity, and infrastructure projects. Well, welcome back, Daniel. It's really good to have you again.
Well, thanks for having me back.
You know, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your latest Mermican report dated 14th of January. It was headed up Clearly Crooked. As you noted in your report, if markets are free, price movements are distributed normally and randomly. Otherwise, if price movements were at all predictable, then there would be an arbitrage opportunities offering profit, you know, free profits to people who were smart enough to catch it. As traders moved to exploit these profits, the profits would disappear, and you shouldn't see any kind of abnormalities in or patterns that are that sort of stand out. That should be true as much as ever now, given the fact that we have huge amounts of capital driven by supercomputers that can instantly move money back and forth to take care of the tiniest of profit opportunities through arbitrage. Yet you have noticed some very distinct pricing patterns in the New York gold markets. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, there's a graph I got on Ed Steer's daily report from Nick Lair that showed that if you look at the average gold price in 2013, you know, it is not random and it's not normally distributed. There is a defined pattern, and the pattern is that gold rises in the overnight hours when the Asians are trading, and then it plummets towards New York, toward the New York trading hours. And I have to say, this has been going on for a long time, and my view at one point was that gold always moves from spenders to savers. Mm-hmm. And Americans are spenders, and the Chinese and the Indians and the Asians tend to be savers. And so one should expect, therefore, gold to move from the West to the East. Mm-hmm. And indeed, this has been happening for over 2,000 years. You know, I think at one point Kmart had a special where you could go in and you know, hawk your old jewelry you didn't want, and they give you credit so you could buy a toaster. and the toaster breaks in a year, and of course the gold lasts forever, but now it's somewhere else. So if that were the case, you know, one might expect that during Western hours, when people are on average selling gold, that the price should move down, mm-hmm. and at night when the Asians are trading and they're mostly buying, it should move up.
Sure.
But you know, the problem with that view is that if you look at the chart that Nick Lear prepared, you know, there are two moments in the day, the AM and London PM fix, when the price plummets. Now, mm-hmm. this cannot be a you know, movement, a sort of natural trend, because both these points are during the Western hours, and both are dramatically different than the rest of the trading day. So, to me, this given the theory that prices must be normally distributed, or someone will take advantage of it, the fact that you have these two outlying points, you know, demonstrates to me that someone is manipulating the gold market at those times. And indeed, in the last few weeks, you know, the Germans have especially brought pressure. I think Deutsche Bank has now withdrawn from that fix because I think they realize that bad revelations are about to happen. And so hopefully, who was it who said that sunlight is the best disinfectant? Well, that seems to be what's happening in this case.
Mm-hmm. Well, so what you're saying is these two price points, or price, the timing is it goes with the London PM and AM fix. Is that it?
That's right. Twice uh-huh. a day in London, uh-huh. a bunch of banks get together and they decide what is the price of gold for uh-huh. these two points. And uh-huh. the reason this is important, because there are all sorts of hedging contracts and derivative contracts that refer to these points. And so it's like the LIBOR scandal, where uh-huh. when you have tens of trillions of derivatives priced off a number, and then a banker can just set that number, he's obviously going to set it or manipulate it in tiny amounts. But when you're dealing with so much money, tiny amounts can amount to a lot. And so you see this happening in the gold market the same way it was happening in the LIBOR market. And I think they're investigating the currency markets now too. So it turns out that all these markets are, I don't want to say rigged necessarily, but they certainly are susceptible to being manipulated by the market makers, the guy trading. And of course, if they're making the money, it means someone else is losing the money. And
sure,
who's losing the money? And the answer is their clients, other traders, the companies that hedge their gold through these bullion banks. So they're basically picking the pockets of their own clients.
So it's very much, I guess, the gold fixing was meant to be very much like the LIBOR fixing, eh? And that is like it's supposed to be market dependent. And the bankers would gather all the data, supply and demand data, and come to some decision on that basis. And I mean, why did they need to have a fixing of the price in any event? Why not just let the markets have a continuous pricing mechanism?
Well, I think there was a reason, probably more applicable in the past, which is that if you said, hey, okay, what is the price of gold on January 2nd? Well, what is the price? I mean, it moves around all day long. So if you have a contract and you need to deliver something based on that price, you need a reference point. I suppose today with computers, you could use an average or moving average or all sorts of things. But certainly if you look back 100 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to do that. So you said, okay, well, it will be this reference price. And who should decide that reference price? Well, all the people in the gold market kind of get together. All the representatives get together and they pick a methodology to do that that's more or less fair. And that's where everyone signs on to it. This seems to me to be somewhat anachronistic today in the age of computers when you can probably derive some price on your own. But it is useful to have a price, especially if you wind up in litigation. And, I'm a former lawyer, as you know, and it's nice to have some clarity in contracts what you're talking about. So it's not that, having a set time or a set methodology is necessarily incorrect, but it one would think that the market, the clients would look at the bullion banks doing this to them and say, wait a second, guys, we're not going to do business with you if you're going to treat us like this. There seems to be some sort of Stockholm syndrome in the financial markets. I mean, you read constantly Goldman Sachs screwing over their own clients and they keep going back for more. I don't quite understand that. But there it is. And, either the theory is wrong and prices are not normally distributed, which seems hard to believe in sort of a short-term basis, or someone is manipulating these prices.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed, Dan, is in watching the gold markets here in New York, is that you have a smackdown early in the day, and then it sort of claws its way. This has more recently clawing its way back up to where it started or even sometimes above.
Yeah.
What do you make of this? If you see the same thing, is this a pattern that you've noticed too or not?
Of course it is. I mean, certainly the last year or since gold's been in a downtrend, you've seen large seller orders during the illiquid times of the day. We've all seen those waterfall declines when someone sells so much gold it takes out the entire bid stack and the market freezes. And these are obviously not people looking to get a good price on their sales, people trying to move the price to a certain point. Now, I've talked to some guys in the high-frequency trading business, and what they tell me is they say, oh, no, look, there's false liquidity is their phrase. They're saying, look, if we dump 100,000 contracts in a second and the market can't absorb it, then the price should be lower, and we're just helping it to get there faster than it would otherwise. We're just being an efficient market maker. That's their view. Possibly, but one has to remember that in markets today, almost every market today is defined by leverage. So you have people who in the stock market, in the bond market, in the real estate market, every market has a lot of leverage. And if you push the price down, low enough, you get cascading margin calls. So, to me, what's happened is that even assuming that they are correct, that they were just doing the market a service by, taking away all the leverage in the gold market, and what's happened is there's no more leverage in the gold market. It's gone. I mean, anyone who was on leverage in this market was taken out over the last 2 years. And actually, if you look at the COT reports, what you see is the bullion banks and the traders who are in the markets balancing physical risks. So they're not on margin. These are real positions, are now on the long side, and the short side are the macro fund traders. So they're the ones that, who are levered. So if we get into a situation where, you know, leverage starts disappearing out of the system, which is what always happens after a big run-up in credit, when credit bubbles collapse, leverage goes away. In my view, that's already happened in the gold market, and actually the leverage is on the short side. So what you should see is when the broader markets start really falling apart because the margin debt is too much, then everyone gets margin calls. You know, that will translate into margin calls for the shorts in the gold market, which I think will push gold higher, not lower, because it's already gone through that that cleansing process.
So we'll see a melt up possibly. And you've pointed out before that, that generally in the equity markets you see the opposite because there's leverage on the upside. You know, and in fact, what I've seen recently, the reports I've seen, is we've had almost record amounts of margin buying in the stock market. So if that, if the margin clerks start to call there, you could see a waterfall down in the equity markets. Is that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, you know, the thing with the equity markets is that, you know, at their base level, they represent the big companies that operate in the economy. And so everyone can win. Right. I mean, the economy starts working better, companies work better, the values go up, and everyone makes money. And then you have on top of that people operating on leverage in these markets. And you've got a few short sellers, but that's just a tiny piece of the equity markets. I mean, the market participants on average are overwhelmingly long because they own the companies that own the assets. People, you know, most, you know, casual investors don't really understand that the futures markets are different. In the commodity space, future markets are a zero-sum game. You have longs and shorts. No one sits on oil for 10 years at a time. It's not like an asset that goes up in value. It actually goes down in value. You've got to store it, and there are all sorts of costs involved in holding it. So longs and shorts are evenly balanced in the futures markets. What that means is that you can get these waterfall declines, as we saw in gold, when, you know, the longs are over-levered and shorts put pressure on them. But you can equally see big spikes on the upside when the opposite happens. When the shorts get cornered, you know, they're over-levered and the longs push the price up, but now they've got a cover. That doesn't really happen in the equity markets. You don't see the price shoot up, you know, 10% in a day because there's a short squeeze. I mean, there's been a melt-up, certainly. That's part of the tops of equity markets are sometimes defined by the shorts being taken out, like in the internet bubble or recently. But you don't see sort of big flashes of the upside the way you can and do in the commodity markets.
Because the shorts get smoked out. What about so? What if I understood what you're saying, Dan? The bullion banks are largely not on the short side now. It's more the hedge guys.
Well, yeah. The latest COT reports show that the producer category, the commercial category, actually do business with bullion is long, and that is very unusual. I think the last time it happened to, was 2008. And before that, I don't know. I think before the bull market started in 2001. And the reason is, you know, bullion banks are always short or should always be short in the futures markets because they're hedging their long exposure. Right? They have loans to gold mining companies or they have gold sitting in the vault. And so they have physical long. And banks are not supposed to. They might. They do. But they're not supposed to take big price risks. They're supposed to hedge their exposure to various things. They take fees for adding liquidity. And so to manage their long physical side, they keep a short futures market side. And that's the way the market's supposed to be. So if the bullion banks are in fact long, right, and they have physical exposure through their loan books, it really tells you something. And my view is what does it tell you? It tells you – what it tells me is that they've taken client gold that's sitting in the vault and belongs to their clients, and they shipped it to Asia. And why would they do that? Because in Asia, the premiums are very high. So so they can take an ounce of gold in New York, fly it over to Hong Kong, make $15 on that trade, right, and then use the money and buy a futures contract. And then now they're short physical because they sent someone else, their clients, gold to Asia and they're long the futures markets. But that, you know, that implies that when the price starts to move, that the bullion banks have to take delivery because they've got to replace the gold they've shipped to the East. And so if you're short in the futures markets, who are you going to buy your long from? It sets up a situation that you can have very explosive moves to the upside.
And if the gold is all shipped to Asia in stronger hands, or people that are not interested in turning a quick profit but see gold as a long-term store of wealth, where is the gold going to come from then if they need to go out in the markets and buy it to cover?
Well, that's exactly right. And my understanding is that the Chinese are currently importing more gold than the world mines
are producing.
So, yeah. In fact, there's a big, huge net drawdown of gold in the West going to the East. Again, there's nothing new about this. It's been happening for thousands of years. But to the extent to which it's accelerated since the big price match in April is remarkable. And, you know, in my view, basic economics tells you that when a price goes below the market price, you should get a shortage. Right. When the Soviet Union says potatoes only cost 10 cents and they cost a dollar to make, what happens is there's still potatoes, but there's a shortage of them and only the people who are connected get them. Mm-hmm. And what's happening in the gold market, I think, is that the paper price has been pushed way, way below the market price. And so what you're seeing is a shortage in the physical markets. And this comes out in giant premiums for people who really want to buy physical. They've got to pay up for it.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, again, getting back to the bullion bank's position being an unusual position for them and not being so net short or being net short. I think it was a guest we've had on here a few months ago, weeks ago anyway, that talked about how he really watches that. And he, if you do what the bullion banks do, you're usually going to do pretty well. Do you agree with that? The bullion banks are on the if they're not on the short side now, that's pretty bullish, perhaps, for gold.
It's very bullish on the long side. I think so, because, again, I think that, I mean, again, theoretically, they're not just trading like a day trader trying to make money. They are responding to flows in the markets, and the reporting tells you what's happening under the surface in the physical market. And at the end of the day, the physical market should determine the price of the paper market. Now, you know, the amount of leverage in the system has meant that the paper market has been dictating the price of the physical market, but that can only continue for so long because the physical market will adjust, i.e. the gold disappears, such that at some point you'll have a big reversion in the paper price. And I think that's what's going to happen. You know, people think there's a lot of chatter that the bullion banks will default at some point. I don't think that'll happen, but I do think that to resolve the physical flows, the gold price has to go much, much higher. And given the leverage in the system on the short side, that could happen in a very dramatic and short-term fashion.
Mm-hmm. Well, if the bullion banks have lessened their short position, then there'd be less danger of that if it takes place now, right? Of them defaulting.
Well, that's right. I think that's exactly.
The hedge funds will be the guys. The bullion banks always get. These are the big international money center banks that always seem to come out ahead, no matter what.
Yeah, and the other thing is that they won't default because the reality is if they get into trouble, the governments will bail them out. Gordon Brown bailed them out in the late 90s. They all got bailed out in 2008. And I believe that is on the COMEX, you know, in a crisis, they can just simply paper settlements. They can give you cash. They can say,
exactly.
You know, the COMEX is not meant to be. It was never designed to be a place for people to buy and sell gold. It's a place for people to place side bets on the price of gold. And that's a subtle but very important distinction. And again, as I mentioned, you know, what's happened is that those side bets have wound up determining the price of the underlying commodity.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a strange, weird outcome, but it's temporary. I mean, you can't have the side bet determining forever the price of physical supply and demand in the market. It just can't happen.
Yeah, the tail wagging the dog, kind of. Well, what we're seeing, though, Dan, is that I think it's in Singapore, Russia, Shanghai, I think South Korea, a number of countries are now starting their own bullion exchanges, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yeah, no, of course they are, right?
And because these are people that really want to take delivery, and maybe they're looking at the COMEX and the London and the U.S. markets and saying, well, wait a minute, there's no gold there. We don't really want to play that game. We don't want to accept dollars if they don't have the gold, which is...
Well, exactly. It's even deeper than that, which is that they're not looking at the COMEX as much as they're looking at the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. And they're saying, wait a second, you know, most foreign reserves in the world are dollars. And what is the dollar? The dollar is a liability of the Federal Reserve. Well, what does that look like? Well, it used to look like short-term government bonds, you know, U.S. government bonds, and now it looks like long-term government bonds with exotic mortgage-backed securities on them. And the Fed seemingly determined to destroy their balance sheet as fast as they can. So, you know, obviously, if you're a different country than the U.S. and you see this happening, you want to keep your foreign reserves in some other way. and you don't exactly want to run to the euro with all these problems. And so what do? And you know, the gold always was and always has been the ultimate foreign reserve for thousands of years. So why wouldn't you do that? And knowing that if you buy it in the paper markets, you're going to get screwed by these big banks and by the system, you know, of course you want to buy the physical instead.
Right. Well, in fact, you mentioned the balance sheet. And you talked about that in your January 14th missive, noting that, you know, if the Fed keeps doing this, people will look at this, you know, people will be looking at this balance sheet. We start to see interest rates spike. That balance sheet really starts to become problematic, right? And do you see that happening now, Dan? Do you think we start to see rising interest rates that could really sort of trigger and catapult fear of the U.S. Solvency, the dollar's legitimacy?
Yeah, that's the key point, right? I mean, you know, I'm obviously very happy about gold's movement since the beginning of the year, but this latest spike up has occurred in the context of Treasuries rallying. Mm-hmm. And so there's this sort of, you know, risk on, risk off trade. And when risk is on, you're in stocks. And when risk goes off, you switch to treasury bonds and gold. Mm-hmm. And so that's the current context. And that's why this is not the beginning of the end game, because what the end game will look like is rates spiking and gold spiking. And that can happen pretty much any time, which is why you've got to be in the market. Because if you miss that, then your wealth will be permanently impaired. But yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the rates crept towards 3%. They crept over a little bit. Now we've seen a big reaction. This happened, I think, you know, when the dollar crept up to 100 on the yen, and it was obvious that the yen was going lower because, you know, the QE program in Japan is many times the size as it is in the U.S. If you adjust for the size of the economy. But, you know, as it crept towards 100, so many people were on the wrong side of that trade. In other words, they were so convinced it was going up, you saw a big reaction first. And I think that's what's happening now to the treasury bond market, is we crept to 3%. There were some rumors of some big macro hedge funds in London who took giant positions that rates were going to go higher, and it seemed like the market is teaching them a lesson.
Yeah.
But it seems unlikely that rates will go down. I mean, what you have is the Fed says they're going to taper, so you're removing a giant buyer of treasury bonds, and the Congress is now debating how to increase the spending, which will increase the supply. And so when you have decreased demand and increased supply, it's hard to imagine the price going any other way than down and rates going up. Mm-hmm. I would say that there is a possible sort of exception to that. There's a reason why treasuries might rally a lot, and that is if you get into their debt waterfall decline,
right,
where they don't print enough money to allow debt to be serviced, and there's $70 trillion of debt in the United States, then what happens is there's a short squeeze on dollars, and everyone's got to scramble to get dollars, and you know all a treasury is an unimpeachable contract to deliver dollars. And so they become high in demand, and then you get rates going down and treasuries going up. But this will be in the context of another big deflationary move. Mm-hmm. And I think that would, you know, almost require the Fed to intervene. You know, Janet Yellen would have to prove that she has as much of a put, that she's got the back of the market, to use Obama's phrase, as much as Bernanke and Greenspan did. And so, you know, as we talked about offline, you know, when you look at countries that wind up with very high rates of inflation or even hyperinflation, it's not that their central banks are full of psychopaths. It's that they are responding to economic necessity, and they print the money because they're so terrified about what would happen if they don't print the money.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the next round of printing will happen in the context of the Fed being so spooked by what would happen if they don't, that they'll have to really ramp it up. So I think the markets are very vulnerable here. I mean, they've gone straight up. I mean, you look at the chart of the NASDAQ, it looks very similar to the chart of the NASDAQ in 98, 99, and 2000. And when it comes off its parabolic increase, we'll see what the Fed does.
Yeah. Well, indeed, the markets have been, the equity markets have been weak here to start the new year. And I think it was Art Cashin I saw on CNBC last weekend suggesting that maybe there's some second thoughts about continuation of tapering. And it seems to me that the Fed has put themselves between a rock and a hard place here. How are they going to get out of this thing? It seems almost impossible, because the mere mention of tapering has caused not only problems in the U.S., but more importantly, perhaps in the developing markets. We're seeing places like Brazil or Argentina, Turkey, places like that. And so, you know, it almost seems impossible for them to start really cutting back on the issuance of funny money?
No, of course it's impossible. There's no way out for them. I mean, they should have let the froth out of the system after the 1987 crash, mm-hmm. and instead they lowered interest rates. And then they, you know, saved the economy again, lowered interest rates when you had the savings and loans crisis. And then long-term capital management went down. They should have let it go bust, mm-hmm. and teach them all a lesson and take the froth out of the system. Instead, Greenspan lowered rates again and created this moral hazard that the Fed would always bail out Wall Street no matter how much debt they took on, no matter how aggressive they became. And so obviously Wall Street became hyper aggressive and hyper interested in taking on more debt. And so now we have a situation where the Fed proved it again in 2008. So, you know, why wouldn't you act any differently? I mean, the more debt you have, right, the more levered you are to prices on the upside, the more money you make. And as you know that the Fed's going to bail you out, why wouldn't you do that to the maximum extent possible? And that is what all the interested economic actors in the economy have done. So right. The Fed is now in a very untenable situation. If they let the air out now, it will be a real disaster. I mean, the banks will go insolvent again. The ATM machines won't work. But if they print the money, then we're going to have huge increases in prices. And without stable prices, you know, you can't have economic coordination. We live in a highly complex society. That's part of the benefits of being so technologically advanced. But when you get rid of the price signals, you get huge miscoordination. And it's very hard for a system as complex as ours to continue. So bad things are going to happen one way or another. And the whole point of owning gold is that you don't need to worry about how they manifest themselves, because gold will persist through whatever happens.
Yeah, it seems to me we're on a knife's edge almost right now. And as you said, it was a one way with the Bernanke put there, and now the Yellen put. Presumably, there's no reason not to be in stocks. That's the way most people think. And so they've not only been in stocks, but according to some of the information I've received recently, we've almost had record leverage, record margin debt on the stock market. And, you know, now there's ETFs that are leveraged up, which is another layer of leverage that's in the equity market.
And you can probably lever your exposure to levered ETFs.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, I think it was Bill Fleckenstein who said back in 2007, I think, that the Bernanke put might be at a price lower than market participants expect. In other words, the Fed's not going to let the market go to zero, but you know, they might let it go down by half or 40%, who knows? And so if you're that levered to the upside, it doesn't really matter where the put is leveled, because you'll be taken out by the margin clerks long before the market gets there. I think you'd be very cautious. And I don't think the Fed is not eager to act. I mean, if you read the minutes of their meetings, you know, many of the Fed participants realize that their actions have created huge problems in the market. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that they are as nefarious and evil as people seem to think they are, but they're mm-hmm. in a very difficult situation. I mean, if you were on the Federal Reserve Board, what would you do? If you stopped printing the money, you know you're condemning the market to going down 80, 90%, which it has to do to clear all the problems. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean it has to stay there, but it has to go down there to those levels to get rid of all the levered players. You know you're condemning the banks to insolvency and probably government takeover, right? You know you're going to create all these problems. That's a very hard vote to take. On the other hand, you also know that if you don't take that action, that things just will continue to get worse. And so it's very difficult to know what to do.
Well, things will get worse, but hopefully on someone else's time, I guess, is the idea. So,
look, Bernanke must be thrilled he's out of there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he saved the system in 2008, and now he's gone, and if anything happens, it's Yellen's fault.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Yellen is the one who may have bitten off more than she can chew. She's left with the bag.
She probably still believes that it can all be cured by creating more of the same thing. But you mentioned, and I'd like to just read a quote from your letter, January 14th. You said, by depressing yields, the Fed creates a false signal that the supply of savings has increased and sets in motion the boom described by the Austrian business cycle. The prices of yielding assets rise artificially against gold. There is no means to avoid the bust, which brings the opposite conditions, and the greater the credit expansion, the more dramatic the repricing of other assets against gold. It is the reversion to the mean that Mermican was founded to capture. Well, how much, Dan, do you think, I mean, at this point in time, it keeps changing, of course, the more money that's printed, the more financial suppression that takes place, the more out of whack the markets are. But I mean, what sort of, you said 80 or 90% to clear the markets on the downside in the equity markets, what would you see for gold relative to some of these other assets?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm just basically paraphrasing Ludwig von Mises.
Sure.
And you know, this isn't just theory. I mean, the nice thing is this is theory, and then you look at history and you say, wait a second, you know, all these financial panics seem to roughly more or less follow the script.
Sure.
And of course, the eggheads at Princeton are too obtuse to understand this because it doesn't fit with their mathematical models. But you know, it's hard to know precisely, but what you do know is that, you know, looking at these cycles over the last few hundred years, you know, every credit boom involves gold going down in value, as against stocks, as against commodities, against housing, as against everything else, because gold is the bank reserve asset. And so when people don't need reserves because they're levered up so much, obviously the reserve becomes less valuable. And when the opposite happens, obviously people are desperate to get their hands on reserves, and so gold goes up. And it goes up in different extents against different things. I think the equity markets are very levered, not just because they're levered, but the companies they represent are levered,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, I keep reading about the fact that companies have record cash on hand, which is true, but they also have record debt on hand.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of free cash they have can change very quickly. I mean, if their businesses weaken at all and they have a hard time managing their debt, the value of the equity can become zero very quickly or very much less than what it is now. So I think gold is against the markets can go up, you know, who knows, 8 or 10 times, some number like that.
Yeah.
Gold against oil and wheat, I mean, it's not going to go up 10 times. That just doesn't happen. Gold moves in a tighter range against commodities. Mm-hmm. But it certainly would go up somewhat. Maybe it doubles or triples, some number like that. And mm-hmm. you know, my particular focus is the gold mining companies.
Exactly.
And yeah. as you know very well, the profit margins of gold mining companies is determined by the spread between the input costs, which are very correlated with industrial commodities mm-hmm. and gold. Mm-hmm. And so right now those margins are near zero since gold's fall, and the companies are priced for near bankruptcy. So gold doesn't need to go up a lot as against the commodities to make those margins blow up hugely in percentage terms and therefore send the value of those stocks up large amounts in percentage and in percentage basis.
Right. And, you know, I know, Dan, that you and I probably have talked about this before, but after 2008, 2007, 2009, that time frame, the real price of gold, that is the price of gold relative to energy costs and materials costs and so forth, rose very dramatically, and with that came very nice profits for the mining companies. Now, as you say, we're back to sort of zero, where these companies are making little or no money. So you must be pleased so far this year with what's happening. Do you think the equity markets for gold shares might be leading bullion up?
Well, you know, in the past, for whatever reason, the gold mining equities do seem to lead the gold price. This seems very counterintuitive. I mean, they make the money from they peaked first and started going down while gold was still going up, and then I think gold peaked something like 10 months after the mining companies peaked. And it's not obvious why this should be the case, given that they made their money off the gold price.
Right.
But it certainly seems to have been the case. And I guess if one wanted to think in circles about it, gold mining companies are really options on gold or on the real price of gold. And so it may well be that they see into the future because they're really pricing in partly the volatility of gold and other you know, non-obvious price movements like that. But it certainly has been the case that so far this year, the gold mining companies have gone up dramatically, especially the juniors. And that tells you that the market is pricing in a higher price of gold or perhaps a more volatile price of gold going forward, which adds the value of an option and doing so on very, very heavy volume. So this doesn't seem to be a situation where you're having a correction in a down market.
Mm-hmm.
Those tend to happen on light volume, and this is happening very heavy volume. So it looks like people, you know, want to own these things, and it makes sense. I mean, you know, these little companies offer extreme leverage on the gold price, and that makes them ideal insurance. You don't need to put up a lot of capital because you don't need to own a lot of these things. Because if these bad things happen, which seem to me fairly inevitable, these things will go up so much you just don't need that much money to protect yourself.
Right, the leverage. And you noted the last time you were on our show that you are really playing the sort of the juniors that do have more leverage. And I know there are companies that I follow that are sort of break even right now. They're producing, they got good growth prospects organically because they've got cash flow. Those are the kind of companies, and not just the producers, but I guess some of the juniors that are advanced stage that have been smacked down really hard look good to you as well.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the junior explorers, I think, a little less play only because, you know, the better financed ones can dial down their expenditure.
So sure.
They can determine, you know, how long they last. And so the market doesn't discount them as much. They don't really go bankrupt. What happens is they raise money at varying levels at varying times. The operating companies, of course, have bills to pay. And so if the price of gold goes too low, they can, in fact, go out of business. And that's what the market, I think, was pricing them for until recently. But then if they just don't go out of business, that is a big leap from where they have been.
Right.
And if gold goes up and they actually do well, the returns could really be extraordinary from here, and that seems to be what's happening. But you're right. I mean, there seems to me to be an inefficiency in the market at the moment in that the major companies took on lots of big projects, and their costs are not all that different from what the costs of some of the junior mining companies are. But they're valued at many, many times more valuable. And so given that the downside to me looks pretty much the same, but the upside is very different. Well, how would you go with a stock that offered you the same downside and less upside? So for me, I think the juniors offer a lot more value at the moment than the majors.
And we're starting to see some takeover attempts, a big one, Goldcorp, Osisko. Do you think this might also be a bullish sign for the industry?
Well, it's certainly a sign that Goldcorp thinks that gold's going up, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Osisko is a very large mine with very low grade. So it means you've got a lot of throughput and it's high cost. And so, you know, why would you take that company over? Well, you take it over because you think gold price is going up, and you're going to, it adds leverage to your portfolio. So the fact that Goldcorp is swooping in and taking this now tells you that they think the gold price is going up, or they wouldn't do it.
No, they're trying to take it on the cheap,
well,
perhaps,
yes.
And whether they get it or not is another issue.
Any
thoughts on that?
I think the general consensus is that they will get it, but at a higher price.
Yeah.
You know, who knows? But I think also, you know, the other thing it's done is it's put the other majors on notice that this scramble may have started. And so every major, you know, I think they've been looking around at the market. They've been identifying which companies they want to buy, and they've been waiting because – waiting has been successful. The prices keep coming down and they get cheaper.
Right.
Well, you know, if all of a sudden the juniors are disappearing because people are buying them, it may force your hand earlier than you want. So you may have to run to the market and buy it.
Well, I can tell you, as an owner of the juniors, I'm hoping there's some competition when this game starts. There's some that I own. I certainly would not want to see them taken out at current prices. But
I hear you. But you know, one thing to keep in mind, of course, is that even if your favorite company is taken out at what you think is a low price, you get a nice premium, and you can immediately recycle that capital into your other names. And there are enough junior names out there that you can pretty efficiently recycle the capital.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
You know, I don't like to see, you know, obviously you buy a company because you think it's going a lot higher, and then you don't get to see that happen, and it's frustrating. But I think from a broader perspective, it's actually very good because you get that bump and you get to redeploy the capital in the next company that hasn't had the bump yet.
Yeah. Well, I would think that would certainly give an injection into the into the arm of this segment. Osisko is, you know, if even it gets taken out at the prices offered, would put a lot of money in the hands of a lot of investors who would probably start doing exactly what you suggested they do.
That's right.
Start
yeah.
looking at other juniors and down the food chain, perhaps to some of the less developed ones even. So I'm really bullish. You know, we had one guest on this show, Bill Lagner, who's a hedge fund guy, who said he thinks 2014 is going to be a monster year for the gold shares. I hope he's right, but you know, you've been burnt so often, you just don't know for sure. But what's your feeling?
Well, you know, I included a chart in my last letter, if you saw that showed the what happened. The Barron's Gold Mining Index is the longest running index back to 1917, and these are very big companies. So these aren't the little guys; they're the big guys. And if you look at what happened in various global markets, it starts to become very, very volatile. And there are, you know, many, I think 10 times in the past 100 years when the big companies more than doubled in a two-year period and sometimes went up as much as 400%. Mm-hmm. Now, to go 400%, you know, either means that things are really rocking or it means you've had a big decline before that.
Yeah.
But when you've gone down 50%, it's a lot easier to go up 400% than if you haven't.
Right.
And what we've seen is that, yeah, we've had these huge drawdowns. And obviously, you know, people aren't stupid. I mean, the market is down because things don't look great for these mining companies. I mean, that's
right.
Why they're cheap.
Sure.
And so if it turns out that things are actually very good for the mining companies because the costs fall and the revenue goes up, then all of a sudden those expectations are frustrated and people have to scramble to get back on board. And that's how you get big, huge moves in the big companies. And if the big companies can go up four times in 2 years, you know, the little companies can go up. Yeah, you know, that's on average. The little companies can go up even more than that. So I agree. I mean, we're clearly not at the end game of the fiat monetary experiment, and mm-hmm. we know that because treasury bonds are rallying, mm-hmm. and the conclusion of the fiat currency always is when the treasury bonds fall. But you know, gold is so mispriced at the moment; it doesn't matter. It can rally anyway, just because the physical flows have to at some point force the paper prices to respond. And so I think that is what's going to happen this year. We've had over two years now of gold going down at nominal price while the Fed's been printing all this money and destroying its balance sheet.
Yeah.
I mean that was hard to predict.
Yeah.
But I think it's not going out on a limb to suggest that to have another year of this phenomenon. It seems very unlikely. And you know, during that time, during that 2 year period, the equilibrium price kept going higher. So things are not what they were 2 years ago. They're much worse.
Yeah.
So the gold price, if it goes back to, you know, any semblance of, you know, the relationships that gold has fallen for the past 300 years. If you look at the Fed's balance sheet and the Bank of England's balance sheet, the price of gold has to be in a few thousand dollars an ounce or higher.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me very unlikely that we'll persist down here for much longer.
All right. Seems to me like a gigantic spring that's been suppressed and ready to fly.
Yeah, my analogy is, you know, look, the, you know, pictures of the tsunami in Malaysia, right? I mean, the water disappears. Everyone's looking at the pretty fish and the shells on the beach. Well, that's when you should be running for cover, because the only reason the water goes out like that is because it's coming in much, much faster.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's where we are now. You know, we've had this huge wave out in gold and gold mining stocks. It's shaken out everyone, but people who really understand what they hold. And it's really primed to have the wave come back in.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I'm certainly ready for it, Dan, that's for sure.
I think we all are.
Thank you very much. We're out of time today, but I want to thank you very much for your insights. Always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for being with us once again, Dan.
Well, thanks for having me.